Francisco nodded, his face still turned away. The violent grip of his fingers clutching Galt's wrist for a moment was his answer. Galt lifted himself to a sitting posture, slowly regaining control of his muscles. He glanced up at Dagny's face as her arm shot forward to help him. He saw the struggle of her smile against the tension of her resisted tears. It was the struggle of her knowledge that nothing could matter beside the sight of his naked body, and that this body was living, against her knowledge of what it had endured. Holding her glance, he raised his hand and touched the collar of her white sweater with his fingertips, in acknowledgment and in reminder of the only things that were to matter from now on. The faint tremor of her lips, relaxing into a smile, told him that she understood. Donnershold found Galt's shirt, slacks, and the rest of his clothing, which had been thrown on the floor in a corner of the room. "Do you think you can walk, John?" he asked. "Sure." While Francisco and Reardon were helping Galt to dress, Donnershold proceeded calmly, systematically, with no visible emotion, to demolish the torture machine into splinters. Galt was not fully steady on his feet, but he could stand, leaning on Francisco's shoulder. The first few steps were hard, but by the time they reached the door, he was able to resume the motions of walking. His one arm encircled Francisco's shoulders for support. His other arm held Dagny's shoulders, both to gain support and to give it. They did not speak as they walked down the hill, with the darkness of the trees closing in about them for protection, cutting off the dead glow of the moon and the deader glow in the distance behind them, in the windows of the State Science Institute. Francisco's airplane was hidden in the brush on the edge of a meadow beyond the next hill. There were no human habitations for miles around them. There were no eyes to notice or to question the sudden streaks of the airplane's headlights shooting across the desolation of dead weeds, and the violent burst of the motor brought to life by Donnershult, who took the wheel. With the sound of the door slamming shut behind them and the forward thrust of the wheels under their feet, Francisco smiled for the first time. "This is my one and only chance to give you orders," he said, helping Galt to stretch out in a reclining chair. "Now, lie still, relax, and take it easy. You too," he added, turning to Dagny and pointing at the seat by Galt's side. The wheels were running faster, as if gaining speed and purpose and lightness, ignoring the impotent obstacles of small jolts from the ruts of the ground. When the motion turned to a long, smooth streak, when they saw the dark shapes of the trees sweeping down and dropping past their windows, Galt leaned silently over and pressed his lips to Dagny's hand. He was leaving the outer world with the one value he had wanted to win from it. Francisco had produced a first aid kit and was removing Reardon's shirt to bandage his wound. Galt saw the thin red trickle running from Reardon's shoulder down his chest. "Thank you, Hank," he said. Reardon smiled. "I will repeat what you said when I thanked you on our first meeting. If you understand that I acted for my own sake, you know that no gratitude is required." "I will repeat," said Galt, "the answer you gave me. That is why I thank you." Dagny noticed that they looked at each other as if their glance were the handshake of a bond too firm to require any statement. Reardon saw her watching them, and the faintest contraction of his eyes was like a smile of sanction, as if his glance were repeating to her the message he had sent her from the valley. They heard the sudden sound of Donnershult's voice raised, cheerfully in conversation with empty space, and they realized that he was speaking over the plane's radio. "Yes, safe and sound, all of us. Yes, he's unhurt, just shaken a little and resting. No, no permanent injury. Yes, we're all here. Hank Reardon got a flesh wound, but," he glanced over his shoulder, "but he's grinning at me right now. Losses? I think we lost our temper for a few minutes back there, but we're recovering. Don't try to beat me to Galt's Gulch. I'll land first, and I'll help Kay in the restaurant to fix your breakfast."
"Can any outsiders hear him?" asked Dagny.
"No," said Francisco. "It's a frequency they're not equipped to get."
"Whom is he talking to?" asked Galt.
"To about half the male population of the valley," said Francisco, "or as many as we had space for on every plane available. They're flying behind us right now."
"Did you think any of them would stay home and leave you in the hands of the looters?"
"We were prepared to get you by open-armed assault on that institute, or on the Wayne Falkland, if necessary. But we knew that in such case we would run the risk of their killing you when they saw that they were beaten. That's why we decided that the four of us would first try it alone."
Had we failed, the others would have proceeded with an open attack. They were waiting half a mile away. We had men posted among the trees on the hill who saw us get out and relayed the word to the others. Ellis Wyatt was in charge. Incidentally, he's flying your plane. The reason we couldn't get to New Hampshire as fast as Dr. Ferris is that we had to get our plane from distant, hidden landing places, while he had the advantage of open airports. Which, incidentally, he won't have much longer.
No, said Galt. Not much longer.
That was our only obstacle. The rest was easy. I'll tell you the whole story later. Anyway, the four of us were all that was necessary to beat their garrison.
One of these centuries, said Donnishall, turning to them for a moment.
The brutes, private or public, who believe that they can rule their betters by force, will learn the lesson of what happens when brute force encounters mind and force.
They've learned it, said Galt.
Isn't that the particular lesson you've been teaching them for 12 years?
I?
Yes. But the semester is over. Tonight was the last act of violence that I'll ever have to perform. It was my reward for the 12 years. My men have now started to build their homes in the valley. My ship is hidden where no one will find her until I'm able to sell her for a much more civilized use. She'll be converted into a transatlantic passenger liner, an excellent one, even if of modest size. As for me, I will start getting ready to give a different course of lessons. I think I'll have to brush up on the works of our teacher's first teacher.
Reardon chuckled. I'd like to be present at your first lecture on philosophy in a university classroom, he said. I'd like to see how your students will be able to keep their mind on the subject, and how you'll answer the sort of irrelevant questions I won't blame them for wanting to ask you. I will tell them that they'll find the answers in the subject. There were not many lights on the earth below. The countryside was an empty black sheet, with a few occasional flickers in the windows of some government structures, and the trembling glow of candles in the windows of thriftless homes. Most of the rural population had long since been reduced to the life of those ages when artificial light was an exorbitant luxury, and a sunset put an end to human activity. The towns were like scattered puddles left behind by a receding tide, still holding some precious drops of electricity, but drying out in a desert of rations, quotas, controls, and power conservation rules. But when the place that had once been the source of the tide, New York City, rose in the distance before them, it was still extending its lights to the sky, still defying the primordial darkness, almost as if in an ultimate effort, in a final appeal for help, it were now stretching its arms to the plane that was crossing its sky. Involuntarily they sat up, as if at respectful attention at the deathbed of what had been greatness. Looking down, they could see the last convulsions. The lights of the cars were darting through the streets like animals trapped in a maze, frantically seeking an exit. The bridges were jammed with cars. The approaches to the bridges were veins of massed headlights, glittering bottlenecks, stopping all motion. And the desperate screaming of sirens reached faintly to the height of the plain. The news of the continent's severed artery had now engulfed the city. Men were deserting their posts, trying in panic to abandon New York, seeking escape where all roads were cut off. An escape was no longer possible. The plane was above the peaks of the skyscrapers, when suddenly, with the abruptness of a shudder, as if the ground had parted to engulf it, the city disappeared from the face of the earth. It took them a moment to realize that the panic had reached the power stations, and that the lights of New York had gone out. Dagny gasped.
"Don't look down," Galt ordered sharply.
She raised her eyes to his face. His face had that look of austerity with which she had always seen him meet facts. She remembered the story Francisco had told her. He had quit the 20th century. He was living in a garret in a slum neighborhood. He stepped to the window and pointed at the skyscrapers of the city. He said that we had to extinguish the lights of the world, and when we would see the lights of New York go out, we would know that our job was done. She thought of it when she saw the three of them, John Galt, Francisco d'Anconia, Ragnar Donnerschuld, looked silently at one another for a moment. She glanced at Reardon. He was not looking down. He was looking ahead, as she had seen him look at an untouched countryside, with a glance appraising the possibilities of action. When she looked at the darkness ahead, another memory rose in her mind,
the moment when, circling above the Afton airport, she had seen the silver body of a plane rise like a phoenix from the darkness of the earth. She knew that now, at this hour, their plane was carrying all that was left of New York City.